LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to LRIS's monthly podcast, First Thursday. My name is Will Acheson. I'll be taking you through a number of decisions that have been issued in the last 30 days that are of interest. And we have, I guess, in honor of our post-Thanksgiving funk that everybody's in right now, we have a potpourri of decisions from a variety of different sources about a bunch of different issues. And let's start with one of my favorite topics, which is police officers and beards. We've seen rules go back and forth in city police departments and county sheriff's offices and state trooper organizations about whether line personnel, non-plainclothes individuals, can have beards. For a while, it seemed like the rules around the country were getting fairly lax with respect to beards. I know, for example, in my home county of Multnomah County, deputies there have been allowed to have beards for over 20 years. We've seen some agencies go back and forth. My home city, Portland, Oregon, I have seen years when the police chief thought, for whatever reason, it was basically impossible or inappropriate to do policing with a beard. And then the next police chief came along and thought, well, there's nothing wrong about allowing officers to have beards. So we've seen the pendulum swing all over the place with respect to no beards policies. Sort of popping along in the background has been the occasional piece of litigation over whether it is a violation of either constitutional law or some sort of federal statute for a police department to enforce a no beards policy against certain individuals. Now, the first case is that came along is a very old one now. It's over 20 years old. It's called Boyd versus University of Maryland. And Boyd was a sergeant in the University of Maryland Police Department, an African-American fellow. And the department had a no beards policy. Well, Boyd suffered from a medical condition that's known as pseudofolliculitis barbi, or PFB. This is a medical condition that involves the inflammation of the hair follicles, particularly on the face. It is a condition that is aggravated by shaving, and it becomes very, very painful. Significantly, this is a condition from which African American men suffer at a vastly disproportionate rate as compared to other races. When the University of Maryland Police Department wanted to enforce the policy against Boyd, he sued. And he won. And he won because he was able to show that he fell into two different protected classes. The first, of course, would be his race. We had a classic situation where what's called a facially neutral rule, kind of seems funny to say facially neutral in the context of a no beards policy, but a facially neutral rule, that is a rule of a department that doesn't on its face discriminate against any particular protected class, a facially neutral rule that had a disproportionate impact on a protected class. And Boyd was able to show that this facially neutral rule, the no beards policy, had a disproportionate impact both on African American men and on people who were disabled. Disabled how? By suffering from pseudofolliculitis barbi. And as a result, the university had to create an exception for Boyd. Now, as I mentioned, that's an old case. Not all police departments, even to this day, have tumbled to the logic of the case. And that lack of information ended up harming the Newark Police Department, I'd say about 8-10 years ago. And in Newark, we had a very different sort of situation. In Newark, the department realized or chose to make that it would have to make exceptions or chose to make those exceptions for African-American men who could show that they suffered from pseudofolliculitis barbae. And in fact, it would allow those officers to have beards, neatly trimmed beards and everything like that. Well, along comes the next officer. And the next officer in this case is one who is a Muslim. And as part of the tenets of his religion, he cannot shave. The department ends up trying to enforce its no beards policy against him. He sues, and this time he's different than Boyd. He's not raising a claim of statutory discrimination. So he's not raising a Title VII claim based on race or an Americans with Disabilities Act claim. He's not raising any of those claims. He's raising a plain old constitutional First Amendment claim. And that claim is, the employer is discriminating against me because of my exercise of my religious beliefs. My religious beliefs involve, said this officer, involve not shaving. How did that come out? City lost. Why did the city lose? Because it made exceptions for officers who suffered from pseudofolliculitis barbae, but didn't make exceptions for officers whose religious beliefs commanded that they not shave. In other words, a federal court said, look, you can't make exceptions for one protected class and not make an exception for another protected class, particularly one that's constitutionally protected by the First Amendment. And that means you can't enforce your no beards policy against Muslim police officers who believe that they should not change. The ultimate decision of the court there, I'll read you half a sentence here, is the department has made a value judgment that medical motivations for wearing a beard are important enough to overcome its general interest in uniformity, but that religious motivations are not. That, said the court, was unconstitutional. Okay, fast forward now. That's all history, and there's some other cases I could go over, but you get the general theme. Fast forward to 2013, and sometimes I get the feeling that where the rest of law enforcement agencies grab onto a principle fairly early, sometimes those principles take a long time to infiltrate through the massive ranks of the New York Police Department. And in fact, that's what happens in the case of a probationary police officer in 2013 named Fishel Litzman. Litzman is an Orthodox Jew. He follows the traditions of what's known as the Chabad Lubavitch Jewish community, and those traditions prohibit him from cutting or trimming his facial hair. If he just simply lets his hair grow, his facial hair naturally grows out to be about 1 inch from his skin. He got hired, he got put into the academy, and he immediately made a request for religious accommodation with respect to his 1 inch beard. Well, that puts him headlong in non-compliance with a provision in NYPD's, it's known as the Patrol Guide, which is one of the central manuals in NYPD. And a procedure in the Patrol Guide, if you're counting, it's procedure 203-07, generally prohibits officers from growing beards, but makes exceptions for undercover duties, medical conditions, and religious accommodations. But those latter two, the accommodations for medical conditions or religion, are limited to beards that are 1 millimeter or less in length. Back to Litzman. his traditions are that he can't cut his beard at all, and his beard naturally grows out to be 1 inch, not 1 millimeter. So the city turns down Litzman's request for religious accommodation. In the meantime, while all this is happening, he's starting to receive disciplinary warnings, but he's also performing very well. He was ranked in the top 1.3% of his police academy class when he was fired by the city for not complying with the no beards policy. And Litzman sues the city, claiming that his First Amendment rights to freedom of religion were being violated. Well, let's think about this for a moment in the context of the University of Maryland case and the Newark case. The city made an exception, made exceptions for protected classes here, made exceptions for both religion and medical conditions. It limited the exception to a 1 millimeter limit, but nonetheless, it made exceptions. So what's the problem? The problem is that the exceptions and the policy were not uniformly enforced. Here's what the court says. The record shows that NYPD provides temporary exemptions to officers who grow beards beyond the 1 millimeter limit for special occasions. What sort of occasions? Holidays, weddings, funerals. Growing a beard for a funeral? But in any case. Also, NYPD had to admit that officers were out there on the street who had beards in excess of the 1 millimeter length, not just because of the exemptions or because of undercover assignments, but because it simply doesn't enforce the personal appearance standards. So here's what the court concludes. The court says, look, the city makes an attempt to distinguish all these other officers. Apparently there were hundreds of them not in compliance with this no beards policy. Attempts to distinguish all these officers by arguing that the 1 millimeter limit, and I'm quoting here, is really a proxy for the officer's willingness to shave for respirator certification pursuant to OSHA regulations. What does the court say about that? Well, that's not what you said when you fired Litzman, the court says. The record does not reflect that respirator certification was the real ground for his termination, and he wasn't informed that his termination was related to the respirator certification at all. The court says, look, to uphold this rule has to advance interests of the highest order and be narrowly tailored in pursuit of those interests. And even assuming, the court says, that the goal of reaching 100% respirator certification is a compelling interest, the 1 millimeter rule isn't narrowly tailored to that interest. The court ends up by concluding as saying the NYPD provides no legitimate explanation as to why Litzman must be terminated when it hasn't bothered to certify 30% of its officers in the respirator. So in other words, the city's no beard policy falls not just because it makes deliberate exceptions, but because it doesn't enforce the policy. It doesn't enforce the policy with respect to beards, and its justification that officers need to be able to fit respirators to respond in certain types of circumstances, it doesn't even enforce the requirements that officers be certified for the respirator. So the court rules in favor of Litzman, and it looks like Litzman's well on his way to getting his job back with back pay. Now, I went on a little bit at length about this, and the reason that I went on for so long is these same sort of principles apply in a lot of places, and you end up seeing public safety departments get into trouble with respect to these principles. And what's the principle? If you're going to have a policy that has some implications, either on somebody's protected class status or on their constitutional rights, you better make sure that that policy has an important justification and that you uniformly enforce that policy. You've seen it with these grooming code cases for many, many years. You're starting to see it with tattoo cases, where bans on tattoos or where tattoos may be visible, which, as you can imagine, might have some constitutional implications, either in terms of the right to privacy or the tattoo could well be expressive. You're starting to see it with employers that are unevenly enforcing their tattoo regulations or residency rules. Any disciplinary rule that has some potential constitutional or protected class impact has to be uniformly enforced, or the employer may well be in trouble on it. Okay, lecture over. Next up is another constitutional case. This is a free speech case. It comes to us courtesy of the District of Columbia Metropolitan Department of Police, and suffice it to say that the labor relations environment in the DC Police Department is probably one of the most contentious that is out there in any big city. It's produced an awful lot of court decisions over the years, challenges to the employer's decisions with respect to deployment, claims of retaliation on the basis of union activity, lots of different pieces of litigation. It's spilled over into the news media with columnists and bloggers citing both sides, and many of the cases pose two central protagonists. And one of the protagonists is Police Chief Kathy Lanier, and the other protagonist is Christopher Bauman, who is the president of the chairman of the Fraternal Order of Police, which represents rank and file officers. Each of these protagonists have won some of the cases that have been litigated and have lost some of the cases that have been litigated. My observation is that Bauman probably wins more than Lanier does, but he didn't win this recent case. And it is, I think, a fairly important First Amendment case about the release of police department materials to the public. So here's what goes on in this case. It comes out from an incident in 2009 when the department's emergency response team responds to an incident where a suspect barricaded himself inside of a residence. And during the standoff, and it was a fairly lengthy standoff, there was a radio exchange that took place. And the radio exchange concerned whether or not gas should be deployed. And I don't need to go over the entire radio exchange, but it's very clear that there was confusion out at the scene, and there was a real question as to whether or not the deployment of tear gas would put officers in jeopardy. Now, not just whether it was a good idea, but and that was an issue as well, but whether or not there were some safety issues attendant to it. Eventually, that issue gets resolved. It gets resolved, by the way, without the deployment of tear gas, and the department starts a criminal investigation into the incident. Criminal investigation is into the suspect. It's not into any officers out on the scene, but there's a criminal investigation that starts. While that investigation is ongoing, on the Monday after the incident, some of the emergency response team members got in touch with Bauman and cited the fact that someone outside of the team interfered with the barricade scene by getting involved in this radio traffic. Bauman then listens to the radio transmissions and released a portion of the transcript of the recording to the media. Chief Lanier then disciplines Bauman for releasing the recording, citing a department rule that prohibits the release of department materials while the investigation is pending. And Bauman files the latest piece of litigation between these two protagonists, as I mentioned. And he is contending that his discipline violates the free speech guarantees of the First Amendment. And this goes to a federal court in D.C. The court doesn't have any problem with the first half of the equation in these free speech cases. And the first half of the equation is this a matter of public interest? And the court says, well, sure, obviously it is. If you've got a barricade scene that's being mishandled and there are potential safety implications, yeah, that is clearly a matter of public information. But the court says that Bauman's First Amendment rights, while they exist and while they are strong, that those rights aren't, and this is the court's phrase, significantly burdened by the general order prohibiting release of information while a criminal investigation is pending. As the court puts it, the rule doesn't prevent Bauman or any other officer from offering his or her personal views about department policy generally, or the handling of that particular barricade situation. It doesn't prevent Bauman from giving his opinion to the media that after reviewing the recording, he thought the department followed improper procedures. Here's the important part of the court's decision, and I'll just read you a few sentences here. The interests that the department seeks to protect by the general order to limit the disclosure of information like that released by Bauman are real, the interests are, and not conjectural. Bauman released a recording to the media that contained information central to two separate ongoing criminal investigations and an ongoing internal investigation into department practices. In reviewing the recording before releasing it to the union, the department determined it should be for internal purposes only and not released to the public. The court can infer, particularly in light of the department's strong interest in confidentiality and discipline, that releasing the recording to the media, just as the department was beginning to gather information to conduct the investigations, was disruptive to the department's ability to handle the investigations. In other words, the rule is a legitimate one. You can't, an employer has the right to insist that officers not release information about pending criminal investigations, not release that information to the public. And I can't remember a case that's come up just quite like this one before, but the court's decision, I think, is a pretty broad one. Let's head over to arbitration for a few minutes here, and let's start with it's kind of an unusual opinion in terms of the posture, the procedural posture in which this case comes to us. Interesting opinion, though. And it's a sexual harassment, a disciplinary case. Let's set the background just a little bit. Over the last 10 to 12 years, the United States Supreme Court has really tightened up on the standards for what constitutes sexual harassment and racial harassment. And it is just crystal clear today that what the courts might have thought of as a viable harassment claim 15 years ago won't even get to a jury today. It would be dismissed by a court. Employees have to show that the type of harassing behavior is pervasive, that it is very, very severe, that it has been pretty much repeatedly ignored by the employer. It's just very, very difficult to establish a sexual harassment claim in civil litigation. And it was sort of inevitable that the changing rules with respect to harassment would find their way into disciplinary case law. And that's precisely what happened with this arbitrator's decision from last month involving the Snyder County, Pennsylvania prison. And this case all began when the county fired a couple of corrections officers, William Griffith and Heather Rohrbach. And here's what they did. A nurse was working at the scene of the prison. The nurse didn't work for the prison. She worked for a third-party contractor. And she was distributing medications on the cell block when an inmate put a love letter on her cart that contained romantic and sexual language. Griffith, the male corrections officer, accompanied the nurse on her rounds and read the letter to himself when she completed her rounds. And then Griffith gets Rohrbach, the female corrections officer, involved, and the two begin some teasing. The first thing that happens is that Rohrbach reads the inmate letter out loud, apparently in the presence of others. That is embarrassing to the nurse. A watch commander gets involved in the issue, and they discuss the inmate letter while on a cigarette break. And Griffith and Rohrbach participate in joking that the nurse, and their phrase is, likes radiator hoses. And here's one on me. I didn't know this, but apparently a radiator hose is slang for a black penis. I lived this sheltered life in Portland, Oregon, I guess. In any case, the nurse showed no signs that she was upset and didn't ask them to stop. And near the end of the shift, the nurse heard Griffith and Rohrbach, in the presence of some other correctional officers, singing songs with sexual lyrics and laughing. The songs didn't explicitly refer to the nurse, but the nurse thought that they did, and eventually complained. The prison, or the county, fires Griffith and Rohrbach. We don't know anything about their disciplinary records. This doesn't seem like a first-time termination sort of offense, but maybe there was something in the records we just don't know about from the court's decision. An arbitrator finds that Griffin and Rohrbach didn't realize the nurse was offended, had no idea that she would be troubled by the teasing about the inmate letter, and also found that sexual banter was very common in the prison, and hold on to your hats because I know this is going to shock you, the nurse herself had actually engaged in sexual banter many times. The arbitrator ends up determining that Griffith and Rohrbach, in fact, did not engage in sexual harassment and orders them reinstated with back pay. Normally, that would be the end of the case, but the county appealed it. Challenged the arbitrator's opinion in court and argued that the arbitrator's opinion violated the public policy doctrine. Public policy doctrine is this notion that arbitrator's opinions won't be enforced by the court if they violate a dominant and clearly expressed public policy. What's the public policy here? The county says it's the public policy against sexual harassment. And indeed, there is some Pennsylvania case law, and Pennsylvania is kind of an outlier on this issue, but there is some Pennsylvania case law that an employer should have complete discretion to discipline an employee who engages in sexual harassment, and that an arbitrator's opinion overturning a penalty on the grounds that it is too harsh violates public policy. That wouldn't be the rule in most states, but it is the rule in Pennsylvania, I think. And I say I think because there are some decisions that are a little bit in conflict. So there is this public policy notion that's floating around out there. What does Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court, which is a court of appeals in Pennsylvania, say about the county's argument? The court says, look, yeah, you know, no question. There is a dominant policy against sexual harassment. But the mere fact that the employer asserts a public policy isn't necessarily grounds to vacate an arbitrator's award. The award can only be vacated if the employee's conduct found by the arbitrator implicates the public policy and the award poses an unacceptable risk that it will undermine the policy. So the critical issue, the court says in this case, is whether the conduct found by the arbitrator amounts to sexual harassment. Okay, back to the Supreme Court's cases over the last 12 years and the tightening up on the definition of sexual harassment. Does this sort of banter amount to sexual harassment? The court's answer in three words, It does not. For the conduct of non-supervisor co-workers to constitute sexual harassment, the court says, it must be so severe or pervasive that it creates an abusive working environment. Simple teasing, offhanded comments, and isolated incidents, unless extremely serious, don't constitute sexual harassment. Mere isolated vulgar and sexual language, therefore, does not implicate the public policy against sexual harassment. In other words, we as a court, we're bound by an arbitrator's finding as to what this behavior amounted to. And the arbitrator's finding here was that this behavior did not amount to sexual harassment. Therefore, the arbitrator's award of requiring that they be reinstated in the discipline reverse doesn't violate public policy. All right, let's stay with arbitration for a moment and move down to Florida. And a case that involves an interesting question that pops up an awful lot. Let's say an employee has both a grievance and a constitutional claim. So it could be, the grievance could be that the employee has been improperly disciplined, and the constitutional claim would be, I've been disciplined because of my race, or I have been disciplined because of my exercise of a constitutional right, First Amendment rights, privacy rights, whatever it might be. So the same act of discipline, the employee has two claims that arise from that, one constitutional, one a grievance. What impact does the resolution through the grievance procedure have on the later constitutional litigation? And of course, given the dockets, federal court dockets today, we're pretty much always guaranteed that a grievance is going to be resolved before the constitutional litigation is involved. So that's what we see coming out of this case involving Kyle Birmingham, who is a police officer in the city of Claremont, Florida. Birmingham was terminated after he complained to both the city and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement about what he believed to be his chief's unlawful police practices. Birmingham files a grievance with the city. The grievance goes to an arbitrator, and the arbitrator rejects the grievance. The arbitrator finds that the city had just cause to terminate Birmingham and that none of his rights under the underlying collective bargaining agreement had been violated. Birmingham also files a civil rights lawsuit in federal court saying, hey, I'm whistleblowing. It's protected by the First Amendment. And the city immediately raises the defense that been there, done that. We've litigated the propriety of Birmingham's termination in the arbitration, and we won. And the arbitration result should bind Birmingham. And this is an issue that comes up from time, not from time to time, actually with a fair amount of regularity. What sort of deference, what sort of accord should be given to an arbitrator's findings of fact and, in particular, conclusions as to the propriety of an employer's conduct? What sort of accord should the federal court give to an arbitrator? Sometimes you'll hear courts and lawyers refer to this in terms of the Latin phrase res judicata, or sometimes you'll hear it referred to as collateral estoppel. We have modern concepts for res judicata and collateral estoppel. They're called claim preclusion and issue preclusion. But the bottom line is, what sort of deference is going to be given to an arbitrator's conclusions? And the court says, not much. Why? Here's what the court says. Arbitrators have special expertise in the law of the shop. And what that means is knowledge and judgment concerning the labor contract and the working environment. And courts ordinarily do defer to arbitration decisions concerning the meaning of labor contracts, the application of labor contracts, past practice, and those sorts of things that fall under the heading of the law of the shop. However, says the court, and here's a quote, An employee's rights pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement are separate and distinct from rights granted by statute. Where an employee seeks to violate a right granted by statute or the Constitution, like Birmingham's First Amendment claim, the right involves the law of the land and arbitrators are awarded no special deference. Accordingly, this court need not give any weight to the city's offer of arbitration documents. Well, the court wasn't quite done because Birmingham made an argument as well. And the Birmingham's argument was, look, it's not just the documents pertaining to arbitration, the arbitrator's decision, the exhibits and things like that. It's not just those things that should be off limits in the federal court litigation. It should be everything that should be off limits. And the court ends up agreeing. The court says, look, the questions before the arbitrator were whether the termination decision violated Birmingham's rights under the collective bargaining agreement, not whether they violated his First Amendment rights. The arbitrator's conclusions have no bearing on Birmingham's constitutional claim and have to be excluded as irrelevant. And even if they were marginally relevant, the court says, the probative value, the value they would have as evidence, would be substantially outweighed by their considerable danger of confusing the issues and prejudicing Birmingham. Therefore, the court says, all the arbitration stuff not going to be considered in these proceedings. Now, the court doesn't get at one issue that's kind of lurking out there, but it sort of hints at it. The arbitrator in Birmingham's case did not consider whether or not the termination violated Birmingham's First Amendment rights. What if the arbitrator did consider that? Well, just based upon decisions in other contexts, my prediction would be that a court would still say, I don't care what the arbitrator has to say, unless the underlying collective bargaining agreement specifically challenged or channeled constitutional claims into the grievance procedure. Then I think it would be an open question whether a court would give any weight to an arbitrator's decision. However, a proposal by an employer that constitutional claims should go into the grievance procedure, I'm guessing most states would say that wouldn't be mandatory for bargaining. And so the issue would likely never arise. Kind of a complicated, layered set of facts and legal issues here. Pretty fascinating. But I think the court got this one the way most other courts would get it. And that is, arbitrators, it's their business to determine what a collective bargaining agreement is. Courts, it's their business to determine what statutes and the Constitution means. Our next case is kind of an arbitration case. It's a discipline case, and it answers the question that sometimes we pose in our seminars. And the question is, what is the most difficult disciplinary decision for an employer to have sustained on appeal? And when I ask that question, what's the toughest sanction the employer can impose? The toughest one for an arbitrator or a police commissioner or a civil service board to rule in the employer's favor. When I ask that question, normally people will say termination, which is pretty close, but it's not the one. The one is demotion. And why are demotions so hard for an employer to sustain on appeal? And really, there are a couple of reasons. The first is, if you think about it, the level of punishment imposed by a demotion is very, very significant. If a union is doing its job right in the way it's handling a disciplinary appeal of a demotion, you're going to find it calling an expert witness who has the initial CPA after her or his name. And that expert witness is going to say something like this. You've asked me to calculate the monetary effect of the demotion on Sergeant Jones, who's been demoted to police officer. And there's a 15% differential in ranks. Sergeant Jones has another 13 years to go before he reaches his retirement age. If you carry forward that 15% differential and adjust it for, you know, natural changes in the cost of living over the next 13 years, I find that Jones has been harmed by the amount of X dollars by the demotion. But we're not quite done there, because in this jurisdiction, a person's retirement is based on their final average salary. And if their final average salary is implicated by the demotion, well, then we've got to do some more calculations. We have to figure out the life expectancy of Jones, given his gender and his age at retirement. And we look at the retirement formula, and we can calculate that the impact of the demotion on the retirement is Y dollars. I have never seen, when I've done these calculations myself or had them done as part of litigation, I've never seen X plus Y amount to anything less than $100,000. And one of the elements of just cause is the discipline has to be proportionate to the offense. And what offense is so egregious that a $100,000 fine is proportionate to it? That's one of the reasons that demotions are so hard to sustain. The second reason is that demotions are to be used for a very narrow category of disciplinary offenses. What do I mean by that? Arbitrators in particular, but also courts, will say, look, demotion's not your everyday sanction. Demotion should be used for supervisory failures. Demotion shouldn't be a sanction you use for the type of misconduct in which anybody could engage. So, for example, it's perfectly legitimate to use a demotion for a fire captain who has deployed his firefighters at a fire scene, deployed them repeatedly in an inappropriate manner. But you better not use a demotion as a sanction for that same fire captain if the fire captain's problem is absenteeism, because that absenteeism is not related to his supervisory status. It is the sort of offense that anybody could engage in. Well, it's that latter principle that pops up in this case that comes to us in October from a California Court of Appeals involving a sergeant working for the Calexico, California Police Department. The sergeant's name is Sean Sundahl. It's that latter principle that pops up here, but it pops up with a twist, and a very interesting twist. In the eyes of the department, Sundahl did three things wrong, and there were three separate incidents. And one was an order that he gave to a subordinate officer to use a taser to control a burglary suspect. The second was the way he handled a high-tension confrontation that resulted from a domestic violence call. And the third was a failure to report to his supervisors that one of his subordinates had recorded a conversation with a fellow officer. So three separate allegations against Sundahl, and the city fires him. And Sundahl appeals to a police commission, and after a lengthy hearing, the commission ends up determining that although the department clearly had just cause to discipline Sundahl, instead the appropriate discipline should be demotion rather than termination. And the city then challenges the police commission's decision in court. And the case ends up with the California Court of Appeals. And the court ends up putting an interesting twist on the second of the reasons I gave you as to why demotions are so difficult to sustain, and that is the peculiar nature of a demotion. And what the court ends up saying here is, look, all of these three things that Sundahl is alleged to have done relate to his supervisory skills. And because they relate to his supervisory skills, demotion is the appropriate punishment here rather than termination. Let me put it in my language. City, you may have shown that Sundahl could not discharge the responsibilities of being a sergeant, but you know what you didn't show? It didn't show that he couldn't be a police officer, because the nature of his misconduct related to his performance as a supervisor. As the court says in the opinion, none of Sundahl's failings demonstrate an overall unfitness for police work. Rather, what they demonstrate is a lack of communication and a lack of the organizational skills necessary to succeed as a supervisor. The court says, look, we don't necessarily agree that the commission was required to find Sundahl unfit for non-supervisory police work, but what we are saying is, look, although Sundahl's handling of these three incidents showed flawed judgment, and I'm quoting, the deficiencies primarily dealt with his strategic and organizational skills and not the fundamental skills needed for effective police work. Hence, termination overturned and demotion imposed. Next case that's up is a termination case, and it too is a police case, and it takes us back a ways, back to 1997 and an amendment to what was known as the Brady Law. The Brady Law regulates firearms in this country, and this amendment was known as the Lautenberg Amendment. And what this amendment did was to prohibit anyone who was convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence from possessing a firearm. The amendment has been challenged by public safety officers in courts over the years, challenged on a whole bunch of different rationales. There were some claims early on that it was what's known as an ex post facto law. In other words, it criminalized behavior after the fact. It's been challenged on Second Amendment grounds, but all of the challenges have been rejected by the courts, and the Lautenberg Amendment remains a good law. And what it has meant is that officers who are convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence can lose their jobs, and unless they are put into a light-duty, non-armed position by the employer during the period of time that they're not allowed to possess a firearm, and sometimes the disability of not being able to possess a firearm is overturned if the officer completes criminal probation and other requirements. Unless the department puts the officer in a light-duty position, the officer can be terminated. And we just had one of these cases pop up again. This one came out of the federal court in California and involved City of Westminster, California police officer named William Arganda. Arganda was being investigated by the department for multiple violations of policy that involved his off-duty relationships and also involved the unauthorized use of the law enforcement data system. The city terminates Arganda. He makes a request for a post-termination disciplinary appeal, and the city proposes and Arganda agrees that they'll put the appeal on hold pending the resolution of Arganda's criminal charges. Arganda, in 2010, pleads guilty to one count of what's called misdemeanor corporal injury on a spouse or cohabitant. That's a crime under California's penal code. And also pleads guilty to one count of misdemeanor unauthorized disclosure of information from motor vehicle records. He got a sentence of 3 years of probation. Arganda, in the meantime, sues the city, saying that his termination violates due process rights, and immediately up pops the Brady Law and the Lautenberg Amendment. And the city files a motion to dismiss Arganda's lawsuit. Arganda, by the way, claimed that the city didn't accord him the proper amount of due process. What's the court say? The court says, look, when Arganda was convicted of the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, his due process rights were extinguished. Here's the words of the court. Arganda does not dispute that he entered a guilty plea to a misdemeanor domestic violence charge. He also cannot dispute that his position as a police officer required him to carry a firearm and that his domestic violence conviction precludes him from doing so under federal law. Thus, Arganda's property and liberty interests and any corresponding rights to due process were extinguished upon his disqualifying domestic violence conviction. Arganda's answer to that was to say, look, I could have my right to possess a firearm restored someday. And in fact, on my plea agreement, there's a statement that if I successfully complete probation, the DA wouldn't object to my petitioning for relief from the prohibition against possessing the firearm. Court says, you know, that's all interesting, but it really doesn't matter. The fact that he was convicted of an offense means he can't carry a firearm, and that means he can't be a police officer. The words of the court were, the city cannot be expected to hold his administrative appellate proceeding open indefinitely in the event that Arganda may be able to possess a firearm again someday. These terminations for misdemeanor crimes, convictions of misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, these terminations are routinely upheld by courts across the country. And if public safety officers want to do anything about this, there's really only two things that are an option. The first is to try to lobby Congress to change the Lautenberg Amendment. Good luck on that. Hasn't happened since 1997. The second is that an officer who is facing these sorts of criminal charges, that officer needs to have a really good discussion with their lawyer before they plead guilty to a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. It may be that that's the appropriate way to go given the seriousness of the charges against the officer, but if there's any sort of alternative that won't involve the officer losing his job, that's an alternative that should be explored. This last case is going to seem, that I'm going to talk about this month, is going to seem somewhat strange to some of you because workers' compensation laws and pension laws vary tremendously around the country in terms of how they deal with stress claims. This is a case that I think is really a tragic case. It results in a court saying, gosh, we really wish we didn't have to rule this way, but we do. What's the issue? The issue is this. How PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, claims are treated by workers' comp and pension laws really does vary considerably from state to state. Some states only require that the employees show that they have PTSD and that the PTSD was covered by the job or caused by the job. In other words, they have the same standard for stress claims or mental disability claims that you'd have for a physical disability claim. If I break my arm as a firefighter, all I need to do is show that I broke it on duty and that's the end of the issue. And some states say the same thing with PTSD. All you need to do is show that it was caused by an on-the-job event or events. But there's another end of the spectrum. And this other end of the spectrum, what I think of as the most conservative states on these workers' comp issues, require that the employee actually be physically injured in the incident that caused the PTSD. In other words, unless the incident that gave rise to the PTSD physically injured the employee, you cannot file a claim for PTSD. Well, Kentucky follows this physical injury model. And it was the case of State Trooper Benjamin McRae that caused the Kentucky Court of Appeals to issue this really unusual decision, wringing its hands, saying, boy, this is the wrong result, but we don't have a choice. And McRae's claim arose in 2009 when he's called to a domestic disturbance. When he gets there, he's confronted by a man who he thinks is armed with a firearm, and he shoots the man in order to protect his own life. McRae, after that incident, didn't know if there were other individuals at the scene who were armed. He returned to his state patrol vehicle and waited in a wooded area until additional troopers arrived. It was later determined the suspect was armed with a BB gun and not a lethal firearm. McRae, of course, doesn't suffer any physical injuries in the incident. But shortly after the incident, he begins experiencing all sorts of symptoms associated with PTSD. Paranoia, lack of sleep, episodes of rage and anger. Within a few months, he stops working because his rage and anger got to the point where he felt he would end up hurting somebody that didn't need to be hurt. A doctor concluded that McRae suffered from major depression, panic disorder, severe occupational issues, and PTSD, and gave the opinion that McRae was totally and permanently disabled from any form of work due to the severity of his symptoms. McRae files a workers' compensation claim. Kentucky State Police deny the claim, saying, hey, you didn't have a physical injury, and it goes to the Kentucky Court of Appeals. And the court's real factual to start with. The court says, look, it's clear from Kentucky law that an injury for purposes of workers' compensation law doesn't include a psychological, a psychiatric, or stress-related injury unless it is the direct result of a physical injury. By McRae's own testimony, he suffered no physical injuries on the date of the shooting. Ergo, the court says, McRae is not entitled to benefits absent a causal physical injury. Court says, look, we're compelled to acknowledge that McRae is a sympathetic individual, and it's very apparent from reading the opinions of the administrative law judge and the workers' compensation board, they recognize that fact. Nonetheless, we're stuck. We're bound to apply the statutes and the case law in its current form and not as one may wish it to exist. There was a concurring judge, this was a three-judge panel, so one of the three judges wrote an opinion saying, look, I agree in the result, but the court says, speaks rather more passionately than you normally see courts speaking. And I really do want to read you this, this portion of the concurring judge's opinion. The court says, the outcome of this case, while compelled by the lamentable state of the current law, is fundamentally and profoundly unjust, inhumane, and illogical. It cries out for a statutory revision by the Kentucky General Assembly. The wording of the workers' comp statute regarding physical impact under the circumstances of this case has produced an absurd and unjust result in clear derogation of the beneficent purpose underlying workers' compensation. I respectfully submit that it's high time for workers' compensation laws to abandon the physical impact rule. It is a patent disgrace to have to deny recovery to McRae. Boy, you don't see words like that from courts very often, but you know what you do see? You do see these results in states that have the physical injury rule. PTSD in those states almost always, unless the individual suffering from PTSD can show a physical injury at the time, almost always is a non-compensable injury, even though it is acknowledged that it arises out of the job. I want to conclude with some good news about the cost of living. It is continuing to moderate. It's been going on a long time now. The cost of living has been increasing at a very, very modest rate. Since October of 2012, the CPIW, which is the one that, that most labor contracts are tied to, the CPIW for the nation has been 1.0%. That's under a lot of projections. There were a lot of projections that the CPI would be about 2% at this point in time. We're just not seeing that increase in prices. And if you look at the initial reports on Black Friday and the opening of the Christmas shopping season, if you look at the initial reports, it looks like spending was either flat from last year or perhaps even a little bit down. The most I've seen is that spending was up 2.3%. What's that likely to mean? There's a lot of projections right now that we're going to see a lot of sales over the holiday shopping season, and that if we see that, you can expect to see a continuing moderate CPI, perhaps one that continues well into next year at or below 1%. You know what's real striking about these CPI numbers? Say what you want about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, however you choose to characterize it. I don't think anybody can doubt that it's had a hugely moderating impact on the cost of medical care in this country. You remember the days when the medical component of the CPI was increasing at the rate of 10, 11, 12% a year? Remember the days when it was increasing a little bit less than that, at 8% a year? You probably do, because that was only a couple of years ago. You know what it's increasing at now? 2.3% per year. Who knows how long this moderate rate of increase is going to continue? But if it does, because medical costs are an important component of the CPI, you can expect to see yet another downward effect on the CPI as a whole. Well, that's it for our December 1st Thursday. I hope everybody has a great holiday season, and we look forward to next connecting with you in 2014. Thanks.